Welcome back, builders. Today we have a special treat. We have a female builder. We have Liz Abdella. She's from Sencon Homes. She's a mum of four kids. She's been building for 8 years and, you know, let's say she knows a thing or two about the construction industry. What she's going to take us through is the difference between renovation and new homes, and I guess what you're asking someone to do when you're asking them to price and how that would affect a new home versus a renovation. So I hope you find this chat really informative. I know I love speaking to Liz too.
Hi, I'm Rebecca.
And I'm Krabeshni.
And welcome to Building with Builders,
our podcast where we believe that building is fun.
Super fun.
So much fun.
Build Her Collective was created to help women with building and renovating. And we believe that with the right tools, everyone can build. For us, it's all about encouraging women to take back control of the building process and really achieve their dreams.
We are women in the building industry, and as developers, builders, and project managers, it's our passion to share everything we know with other women doing the same. And that's why we've created this podcast for you.
So if you love all things building,
you're into design,
keen on the numbers,
about to renovate,
thinking and dreaming of that forever home and what it would look like,
or even developing for profit,
then you've found your family.
Subscribe to our podcast and follow our journey over at buildhercollective.com.au.
Welcome, Liz. Thank you so much for your time and experience on this podcast.
No worries. Glad I could help.
So, yes, you are a registered builder. Yes, you have been building for 8 years.
No, actually longer.
Longer. Oh, no, registered for 8 years. You've been building for longer than that.
I think close to 15 now.
15. Why'd you do it?
Because I fell pregnant. And I thought I needed a challenge apart from this growing baby.
Yeah, right.
So I thought, you know what? I'm going to build my home.
Yeah. So it started with your home renovation.
No, it actually started with a new home build. And I built two townhouses. And I started as a developer straight away on the block that I had purchased. It was run down. And I thought to myself, you know what? Why not build two side by side, live in one, and then potentially either keep the other one or sell it and then keep doing the same thing over and over again.
And did that work well for you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think back then it was really good because the area that I bought in was quite cheap. And then I think there was also a little bit of luck where in a couple of years the property had doubled in two and a half times, I think, its value.
Right. So you picked the market well. And I guess what I would say is you can't hope for those returns at the moment in terms of you can't hope for property prices to skyrocket. Like they boomed then. There will be a boom at some point, I'm sure, but we don't want to bank on that. But you obviously got the bug.
And you know what? Once you catch that bug, that's it. You just keep going and going and going.
So at what point did you decide to become an actual bona fide?
So what happened, Rebecca, was I did my first one. I did it really well. Then I had a lot of other owner builders ask me to project manage their own builds. And then I just did that. And from there, I kept going. And then I built my portfolio with experience because you have to go before the VBA and demonstrate what you can do and what you've done. I sat my test, which was bloody hard. From there, became a registered builder, and then I started building my own developments with family. So that's a good place to start because they trust you with their money. And then I started doing order jobs. So people started hearing about, you know, the build, or, you know, I would sell something, or there'd be friends referring friends. It just took off from there. So at times we do our own developments / renovations, and we also build for people too.
Yeah, so I guess that's an interesting split, doing your own stuff and doing other people's work. How much of each would you do you think?
I'd probably do 75% for others and probably 25% for myself.
And I know we were talking about that because I am strongly in the camp that I'd prefer to work for myself. And you quite enjoy doing work for other people.
You know what I love? I love it when you do the handover. Like I've got a handover on Monday, and it's so nice when you've actually been able to give somebody something that they love that they weren't able to do on their own. It's so satisfying and rewarding.
Yeah, that is nice. I think that's nice. And there are definite pros in doing work for other people. I guess it just depends on the way you're building. So how many builds would you normally have on at one time?
I've got a general rule where I won't do more than 3 or 4. If they're large ones, it would be 3. If they're small ones, I could potentially get away with 4 at one time. So let's say 1 for myself and 3 for someone else. That way, for argument's sake, in relation to delivery, your one you can put slightly on the back burner, but you don't compromise the builds of others, as in with time, because it's so important that you keep meeting your targets and you don't let the person down. You know, a lot of the times that you do build for someone or you do renovate for someone, they've actually moved out of their home, they're paying rent elsewhere, you know, you've given them your word that you're going to deliver by X date. You want to meet that target so they don't have to push out their lease and then renegotiate, which is going to cost them money that they typically would not have factored in.
That's exactly right. It is money and it does get stressful, especially at the end of the project where you see that pot of gold, as it may be, kind of dwindling down towards the end.
You know what, Rebecca, you do see a lot of what an experience or something quite consistent when you do build for people. Right at the start of their journey or their experience, they're happy to approve, as in the variations that they may ask for. So, you know, so many times, Rebecca, you know, we're about to start, let's say, a bathroom, we're supposed to put these tiles in and they might say, you know what, I just saw something on Insta, can you do this instead? Where they introduce, let's say, a mosaic of some sort or a herringbone, or they want to do that now because they've seen it as an in thing. And then they do it, they'll approve it, they'll tick it off. But when you get to the very end, like your last finishes, if they want something, and then they might say, oh, no, nah, you know what, don't worry about it, because they've run out of money. Or if landscaping isn't in the job, and typically I don't quote for landscaping, that's an opportunity for the customer to save money because they can do that themselves.
It depends where their value system lies as well. It's like, are they the type of people that needs everything to be perfect before they move in? Or are they the type of people that will find satisfaction in doing a garden? So we've been talking a little bit about the difference between a renovation and a new home build. And when you're asking someone to quote or decide, I guess the decision process between doing a renovation or knocking it down and doing a new build, what are some key things that people need to consider or think about prior to deciding which way to go?
I think it's important that the layout of a renovation, so the existing core of the home, so the structure, the layout, actually works with where or the vision that the customer has. So what they actually want of the house. Does the front end work? Is the structure well? You know, plaster you could always rip off and change, but if you've got, you know, cracked bricks on the outside, then potentially you could have a foundation issue. So all of that comes into consideration. So the condition of the home is really important. Sure, you can dress something up and make it look pretty, but then to what extent do you start changing things? Like, you know, do the windows need to go? Does the roof need to be pulled down? Cost is an important factor as well, because as soon as you start changing roof form and altering that, you're exposing potentially the structure in the roof. 9 times out of 10, it's going to be an older roof. So it's going to be, you know, built on site. It's not going to be a truss roof. Therefore, when you have done, let's say, preliminary engineering, and you pull a roof down or have a look inside a ceiling and try to extend or attach to it, 9 times out of 10, your engineering is going to change. And it will change because the engineer would never have allowed for that connection.
Yeah, so I guess to kind of clarify that for people, trusses are, they're normally prefabricated and they're basically using a webbing to maximise the timber use. And so we use trusses a lot in roofs, and also in sort of floors like posi struts, because what we're looking to do is to give ourselves strength and ease of building. So back when they used to build, they wouldn't build it like that. So they'd form it up themselves. And those things are great. And I know they've lasted a really long time, but they wouldn't be compliant by today's standards. And when we start to pull things out and put them back together, we have to put them back together to today's standards. We can't just put them back the way they were. The only place this doesn't actually make sense and doesn't work, and I don't know if you found this, is stumping. So when they're re-stumping a house, they just put them back to like 450 depth like they would have done them previously to re-stump an old house. they just don't have the same level of compliance as what you would have if you're building a new house, where you've got to get the soil reports and the engineering, and you've got to build and design it when you're retrofitting, restumping.
That's right on. So if you are maintaining your house, you can get away, absolutely, you can get away with just keeping it the same. So you'd go to the same depths, which would be like what you've said, you know, 400, 600. However, if you are adding to it and you are typically extending and you do want to extend, that will fall under the new engineered requirements. And they will go down to, let's say, a meter or a meter and a half. But anything existing in that, the existing building envelope, you don't have to technically do that.
No, but if you then decided to put a post, let's say you were putting a post in that house, that post might require a pad footing, which will mean you'll need to rip up the floor around that and put, you know, a meter by a meter pad footing or whatever the engineering report says you need, which is a lot more work. So I guess these are the things that we're considering when we're looking at houses to refurbish them. And so people are looking at little things. They're looking at like cracks on plaster or paintwork, and we're going, well, it doesn't actually matter because all that's coming out anyway. Like that's the first thing we're doing, stripping that.
What we're looking for
is major structural changes and I guess roof lines, because you're right, as soon as you start playing with the roof line, you're adding a whole heap of extra cost, and then what is actually left? Because normally we'll want to change a window or some cladding, or the cladding's rotted or needs to be fixed. So then we're stripping all the cladding. Every time you change a window, you basically change the cladding for the entire wall, and you're stripping out the plaster from the inside. So then you're left with a few studs or a bit of frame, and you're like, well, is that worth keeping or not? And there's a cost versus benefit calculation, which could also be emotional, that we're going through.
And also to that, it's always a lot easier and cheaper for a plasterer to come in and run new sheets than to do joins, especially when you've got an older home and you've got the plaster, the old, you know, the furry plaster, which I call it, versus your normal paper plaster. It's trickier or technically more work for a plasterer to come in and make that join look seamless or always there than coming in and just running new sheets. So a lot of times my plaster would say, Liz, just take that whole wall down. It's going to be a lot quicker and easier for us to put new plaster. So think about the cost of, we'll just patch it up, it's going to be easy, may not necessarily be the case.
Yeah, especially if there's a textured, some of those textured walls, you can't match the texture. You'll always see it. So then you're starting to look creatively at things like, okay, well, maybe I need to put a dado wall there or you know, I'll rip out that whole wall and put something decorative there, because I don't want one, you call it paper plaster, like one sheet plaster and the rest being lather and plaster, if we can see there's a difference. So we need to think about how we tie details together. And really, building is all about getting different materials to meet up seamlessly and go together when they don't naturally want to do that.
With renovations, you're always thinking, because there's always new discoveries. There's always, way, okay, how do we make this look better? Or how do we make this look seamless? Because it's not a new build. Another thing also, like one of the recent ones that I've done for a customer, they wanted all their doors changed and all the door jams changed. And in older homes, today we build with this, like your walls are roughly 90 mil, which is your standard bottom plate. But the older homes, their walls are slightly thicker. So when you're changing the jam, it's going to be more expensive to change an older door jam on an older home than what it would be on a new home. When you're producing timber at a standard size, it's going to be much cheaper to buy than having to go buy something that's going to be custom.
Yeah, and to match, like, you can feel the difference in doors as well. So you really probably want a solid panel door rather than a hollow core or even like one of the mass produced doors. It's these little things that we pick up almost intuitively. If you go through a house and they've just taken all the doors off and replaced them with brand new doors that you might buy off the shelf through Bunnings or something like that, there'll be a disconnect there and it won't feel right. It'll feel like they should have been like a little bit dinted or a little bit imperfect. and they should be solid. So a lot of these emotional things that we're thinking about when we're doing a development, we're like, okay, well, it's actually, it could be cheaper to replace that, but I want to keep it because it's going to feel better, and that emotional connection is really important.
Yes.
How does it, this is fine for you and I are looking at this and we're looking, going through a house and we're going, yeah, replace that, do that. This, like, roughly we're going to be looking at this amount of cost. And I know we both use feasibility templates and spreadsheets to make that happen. How does the average person go, I want to renovate this and it's going to save me money, or I'm going to knock this down and do a new build? What do you reckon the decision process should be?
If you're looking at a renovation, let's say you're increasing the size of the footprint by, let's say, 50%, it's worth renovating. If you are going to at least double the footprint by maybe 1.5 times, you're better off knocking it down and starting again.
And that's from a monetary point of view, but it's not necessarily looking at the emotional point of view. So for developing for profit, and depending on the different areas that we're working in, we work in really different areas actually, so the market expectation is quite different in the two different areas, and the style of properties that we look at can also vary. So I would say for my market, if I can keep the front two bedrooms and it suits the layout, like what you're talking about, there's possibly good benefit in that because the market is rewarding that cottage front if the style is right.
Yeah, but Rebecca, I think only if it's consistent to the neighbourhood character.
Yes.
From my experience and what I've seen in the market, and even when I do my own little projects, if, for instance, you've got a lot of brick veneer homes in a street and you're not keeping with the character because you don't have to, and it's going to cost you, let's say, the same because the extension or the renovation is huge, you're better off knocking it down. But there, if there is character within the home, and let's say you're blessed with having, let's say, 3-meter ceilings, then absolutely keep the front of the house. And then that way it lines up and it doesn't look any different. Another thing that I think people would be faced with that are looking at doing this is if you are in an area where, you know, it's weatherboard or it's consistent, so look at the overlay. So if it's heritage, you may have no other choice but to keep the facade.
Yeah, you're right. So the overlays will dictate what you do anyway.
That's right. We're looking at a job at the moment, Rebecca, in Williamstown, where it's heritage and the customer actually has to keep just the front wall, but she's allowed to pull everything behind and the chimneys.
Yeah, and there's different levels of heritage too. So there's a heritage overlay and that'll basically be a blanket thing that they put on a street, and then there's a heritage register. So the heritage register says this house is significant and then everything you change on that house. So if you're buying something on a heritage registered property, you need to be really careful because you will not have any control over those decisions.
That's exactly right. Yep, absolutely. I see that a lot in Williamstown. It's a beautiful area, but council do get involved quite a bit because it's heritage.
We say that like that's a bad thing, but it's really protecting.
It's really just a time thing. But if you really look at the results at the end of the day, after it's gone through council, it's actually preserving, you know, what's so beautiful about Williamstown.
Right. So it doesn't let those nasty developers like you and me come in and
and put this concrete block wall, you know, amongst these beautiful weatherboards.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Really, I guess the key takeaway there is there's a lot of costs in renovations you can't quote. So when you're speaking to a builder and I'm showing you a renovation, how do I expect you to give me a fixed price quote? Like, what's your process to determine that?
Typically, when I'm quoting a renovation, it's always great if the customer would have a minimum specification. Sometimes I get owners that say to me, oh, can you please quote this? But then it's so important to be able to have, you know, what finish do you want? What type of flooring do you want? You know, what type of tiling? If the customer is able to give, or even if the architect or the draftee assists the customer with the defining or providing a minimum specification, then it makes it easier for a builder to quote, especially when owners are shopping around for a cheaper quote. Because no two quotes will ever be the same. If not enough information is supplied, then a builder is technically going to be making their own assumptions, which if you've signed up to something, not really understanding the assumptions that this builder's quoted on because they haven't been given all the information to begin with, you're going to be seeing variations left, right and centre, which isn't a good thing. It's really important that the right questions are asked by the owner. And if they don't ask the builder, have you done this? Or what type of kitchen have you allowed for? Have you allowed for downlights? Have you allowed for a frameless shower? Have like the stuff that you actually want. Are you, you know, you're giving me tiles from floor to ceiling. Sometimes builders could be, or I've seen this, where they'll put in minimum size of a maximum size of a tile. So they'll say 400 by 400 in their quote. And then while you're building, you'll say, oh, no, I prefer the bigger tile. And they'll be like, oh, that's going to cost you more to lay. You got to look out for stuff like that. Even flooring, you know, sometimes you get builders, one builder would quote a laminate finish, another builder will quote engineered, another builder will quote real timber. What are you getting?
Well, so this is the thing. To really get a price, you need to have a spec sheet which itemizes what exactly you want and do your research. Like the way I tell people to do it is make life easy for the builder. And just say, right, okay, well, I've gone and shopped around and I've got the best prices I can get for these anyway. So if it's, let's say you're getting carpet from Godfrey Hirst and you know that that's being quoted at $200 a broadloom meter, just put that in there, $200 per broadloom meter. And what you're doing is you're making the builder's life easier because they've got to quote every component of that house. And that is a bucket load.
It is huge. It is huge. For us to be able to turn over a quote that is absolutely fixed, you need at least 3 weeks.
Yeah.
Minimum.
Your carpenters, your concreters.
Absolutely. You need to touch base with all your major structural trades. Yep. Because you don't want to put in provisional sum, roof, 30 grand, and then you come to the build and it's like, oh, the roof is charged 35 and therefore I'm going to have to vary at 5. You don't want to deal with a builder that does that.
No. Well, and that doesn't actually give you a fixed price. That just gives you cost plus, really. Gives you a so cost plus would be it costs what it costs and then I'm going to put on more.
In the HIA contract, you've got that provisional table that the builder could put, you know, all these line items in there, tell you that this is fixed cost, but then there's an allowance for that to vary, which isn't right.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is an allowance and that's where you've got to be clever. So I guess one of the things we do at Build Her, and I don't know whether you really know this, but we teach people how to tender and we teach people how to present a document, like why we would go to different builders, how we assess the builders, how we get the right builders on our tender list, and then how we give documents to them so we're getting back the same information. And so something that a lot of people don't do is they don't give you a trade breakdown, and we will specify that people give you a trade breakdown so then you know that I'm looking at 3 quotes from different builders and the concrete's come in. Liz has quoted me 50 grand for concrete and Joe's quoted me 10 grand for concrete. I'm like, well, there's an issue with that concrete. There's no way he can pour a major structural slab for 10 grand. So has he forgotten it? Is he doing something that isn't in the documents or am I going to be caught? So it allows you kind of to give you a little bit of transparency and I guess deep dive on the areas where there's discrepancies. Now, some builders will do that. Some builders will not do that for you. I would say the good builders that are organised, that are actually giving proper estimates and not going, oh, yeah, that's, you know, 250 grand, boof, should be able to give you a trade breakdown and should be able to justify.
Agree. And if you give a builder enough time with all the documentation, so your energy report, your engineering, you know, your full-blown, you know, working drawings, there is no reason why a builder can't actually give you a proper breakdown.
Yeah, a fixed price and a breakdown, because they should be doing that as part of their work and part of their scope. Yeah, I appreciate that, Liz. Thank you so much for taking the time.
No worries.
Liz is actually going to be talking to us a little bit further in the Developers Inner Circle. So what that is a group of women that are all developing for profit, and they're like you, have taken actually not all like you, because they're not necessarily going to become builders like you and I, but they're taking their life into their hands and they're deciding, oh, we want to build for profit and we want to make money by doing it that way and changing the built environment. And so we have a program which helps people kind of through that process, whether it's their first renovation or whether they've done, you know, done and have 8 to 10 you know, townhouse developments on at one time, we can help them kind of maximize and leverage that and get to where they want to be. So your process, you were really clear in defining you want 4 projects on at any one time. One of them you want to be yours. I want 1 to 3 on at any one time and I want them all to be mine. So there's clarity in what we both do and where we're headed and kind of focusing in on, yep, this is our happy place, because, you know, we're both busy. Like, actually, we both have 4 kids at home as a building business. And I think, yeah, that's really special. So thank you.
It is. No worries. Thank you so much for reaching out. And I'm hoping that I could help some of or all of you build hers.
Perfect. We'll give you some links. So this is Liz from Sencon, so S-E-N-C-O-N Homes, and you can Google that and find all about her. So she works in the western suburbs primarily.
The west and the north. So I do come up your way.
Perfect. That's where you'll find us in the backyard having a chance. Yeah, but also understand that you probably want to get in touch with a builder at least 6 months before you want that project go, because good builders will have a backlog and they're looking for that next work and that workflow to be smooth.
Right on. Thanks so much, Rebecca.
Thanks for listening to Building with Builder. We'd love for you to spread the word.
For show notes, links and downloads and other awesome resources and freebies, head to buildhercollective.com.au. And don't forget, that's Builder with an H-E-R.
And if you enjoyed this episode, it would mean so much to both of us if you could take a minute or two to leave a review.
And don't forget to subscribe so you can listen next time as we talk all things building and women making their mark in the building industry.